You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great, but it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going, whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby. Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
I don't think you can still see Venus and Jupiter in the sky because the sun's coming up, but they were very close before, and I got, as soon as I left the house, I saw it, and I'm thinking, you know, if those were two alien spaceships, and to be clear, they're not, but if they were two alien spaceships, that would make everything we worry about seem a lot less important. Highs of 90 today, 60% chance for showers, could be that way through the week, but the tropics... Next 7 days, quiet, and on August 11th, we'll take it. Mike Dettelier joins us now, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. As a matter of fact, Mike, I think you guys will be second-guessing tonight, right?
Yes, sir. We'll be at the Silver Slipper Casino, Beachside in Hancock County, Mississippi, from 4 to 8 tonight. And so Bobby and I will crank it up from Mississippi.
Looking forward
tonight.
Looking forward to that. Let's talk about, man, let me tell you something. You know, I always tell you this every year. I hate preseason because it's hard enough to determine what you're looking at during the regular season because you don't know what we're trying to do. You don't know what they're trying to do. In preseason, I have no earthly idea what anybody's trying to do. So with that being said, I'll open the Open Heart Jeweler talking text line at 504-260-1870. Tell me what you saw. Mike, I will say this before I turn it over. The one thing I did see that I did not like was people not knowing when they were supposed to go on the field. That to me, I know it's preseason, but by God, you should know whether you're going on the field or not. Thoughts?
Yeah, you know, preseason is good and bad, and there's only one thing consistent with it: inconsistency. You see one or two good plays, and you see two or three bad plays. It's part of preseason. I get where you're coming from. It's an evaluation process from a coaching standpoint. Of you physically know if that guy can play. Now you want to know, does he mentally know what to do out on the field all the time? That's the big part of preseason. Does he mentally understand what you've been teaching him for the past couple of weeks, and can he relay that out on the football field? And I think that's a big part of preseason, and you've got to look at individual play. People say, well, I want to see consistency. I want to see team play. You're not going to see it. You might be playing alongside a guy that's not going to play in this league, okay? And you might be up against a guy that is not going to play in this game for a long period of time. I think the one negative I saw yesterday that really stuck out to me was the Chargers' physicality along their defensive line shut down any running game the Saints had, which was zero.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nothing. I mean, they slammed the door shut on there. The one thing with Jim Harbaugh and his teams, and it shows up when they got issues if they lose people across their offensive line, just like the Saints will too. But, man, their defensive line was really good. And they slammed that door shut, and that puts a lot of pressure on your young quarterbacks. Then you got to throw the football all the time, and you got to make it count. And I think for one of the things with young quarterbacks, they have to kind of get over is that every play has to be a home run. And it's not. That's not what this league is built on. It's not that way. But you feel that pressure every time because you had nothing to back you up in the running game. Saints offensive line got pushed around yesterday for the most part.
Trevor Penning goes out on a cart. Before that, Will Clapp is around for one play and goes out on a cart. I'm not impugning anybody's integrity here, but That's not good. I mean, you got one preseason game under your belt and you lose two offensive linemen? Let's hope it's not serious.
Yeah, and Trevor, you see, even if you get moved inside, he still has the technical difficulties that he had at tackle, at guard. He's got the same problems. He's played way too high and he gets pushed back. Man, he's got to stay lower in this league. Again, with Clapp, I didn't see exactly what happened. I'm not sure the exact injuries. The one guy, though, I will give a lot of credit up front for, and Bobby had told me, Mike, I think he's got some talent, and that's Torricelli Simpkins.
The center, the third.
Yeah, he went, you think about this, because Clapp was going to see a lot of time, and Simpkins, man, hey, kid, get in there. You know, and it was early that Clapp went down, and I saw him a lot at South Carolina. He's a big guard center, and I thought he played. It wasn't all clean, really, as a pass blocker, but, man, he's got a shot to make this team. He's got some physicality that I like in that player, and, again, he's a big center. There's not a lot of 6'5", 320-pound type centers in this league. Normally, they're not that size. But I thought he stepped in there, and it's one of the most difficult positions to play out on the field. Other than quarterback, you got a lot of responsibilities when you're a center. I mean,
Him. You could see him turn around a couple of times and make the calls, and it's like, that was very impressive to me as well, Mike.
Yeah, I thought, man, you handled this like if I was your coach, I would say, that's what I want to see from you. Okay, I know if you can play or not, but I wanted to see your poise and being put under the kind of high-pressure stakes of being thrown in a lot quicker than you might have wanted to be thrown in and probably at a position that you weren't necessarily going to see a lot of action with. And I thought he did a really, really solid job handling that center position. Now, the guards, he got called for a penalty, but that wasn't his penalty. The referee messed that up. That was on Trevor Penning.
Yeah, those referees, preseason for them too, right?
Big time because, again, you'd have to explain to me about that safety stuff.
Yeah.
With Christian Boyd, who – he's one of the guys yesterday, when you watch individual play, he was very physical up front. He got a nice push. Now, he can stay low because he's not a tall guy. And so he's difficult for you to get your hands on. But he really did a nice job of pushing that inside pocket when he was in there playing for the Saints and against both the pass and the run. Again, on defense, I thought overall – you did a solid job. Again, man, you had some difficulties when Trey Lance was in there stopping the mobile quarterback who took off and run with it.
Now, let me take a break, Mike. We'll pick it up. We come back. We'll talk about quarterback and more. Mike Dettelier is our guest. He'll be here for the hour, 504-260-1870. If you want to share any questions or observations you have about the Saints game, that's the Oak Quinnard Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Don't ever text and drive now, especially that schools are open. With that in mind, let's take a look at traffic now on WWL. 627, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mike Dettelier. He'll be second-guessing with the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert, tonight from the Silver Slipper Casino on the beach in Hancock County, Mississippi. Mike, I'm going to table the quarterback conversation because I'm going to pick it up after when we have more time. But let's talk about, after the news, that is, let's talk about wide receivers and what you saw.
They weren't getting a lot of separation downfield. Again, it was, man, it was inconsistent across the board. Mason Tipton, you can see, he's got some talent now. He's got to refine his route running skills. But, boy, he got open on a kind of a stop, stutter, go downfield. He was wide open. What I loved about that play, and a lot of people ain't going to talk about it, that Tyler Shuck had time to throw the football because of one guy. Clyde Edwards-Helaire, he picked that dude up that was coming in. You could see the Chargers were going to blitz him in between the center guard, and Clyde picked it up and caught him and stoned him. Bow! It gave enough time for Shuck to make the throw downfield to Tipton, but Man, it was inconsistent, Tommy, across the board, and them getting separation downfield. That's an area this football team has got to look to try to upgrade either via trade. I don't know about the waiver wire. I think you might have to make a trade to pick up another receiver here to help out your young quarterbacks.
Give me some names. Who might be out there? We'd have to wait to see who gets cut, I guess, right?
As far as cut's concerned, man, I don't know about that. You may have to pull the trigger on this and go after a young player in a trade with another team or a veteran player that maybe is not quite part of a new fit with another team also. I do think when you look at that and also offensive line, I know we talked about this last week, offensive line, wide receiver, tight end. To me, those are still areas major concerns about because you don't have a lot of depth there.
And yet we were talking about four out of five of the offensive linemen being number one draft picks. That was before any injuries happened yesterday. So I don't know, man.
You still need work.
Yeah.
You still need work there. I did like Banks, though, from a technical standpoint. I thought, his setup, his ability to bend his knees and pass blocking, I thought he did a really solid job there.
Kelvin Banks, number one pick, right, from Texas?
Yep, correct.
Right. We'll take a break, pick it up with Mike to tell you. When we come back, we'll talk about quarterbacks. Again, it's hard to know what was called, what wasn't called. I think, from my own amateur opinion, that Chuck looked a lot more confident than did Spencer Rattler. And it seemed as though Spencer Rattler, you know, like they say in golf sometimes, was playing not to lose and Tyler Chuck was playing to win. But, again, I don't know what I'm looking at in preseason. Who does? 6:30 time now, WWL First News. 6:44, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Mike Dettillier. He'll be second-guessing on the beach, Hancock County, Mississippi, at the Silver Slipper Casino this evening with Bobby Hebert kicking off. It runs through what? Super Bowl, I guess, right, Mike?
Yeah, last show is the Monday after Super Bowl Sunday.
All right, they come home in between. They don't stay there the whole time. Just be clear. Tell me about quarterbacks because, you know, I'm getting text here about Mickey Loomis is a bonehead. Shedeur Sanders threw two touchdowns. Again, preseason, who knows what's going on. I do know that Tyler Shuck seemed to be playing to win. Again, just my amateur opinion, and Spencer Rattler seemed to be playing very conservatively. I don't know. Thoughts?
I think with Rattler, I just thought I would see a little bit more out of him. Now, again, both guys had turnovers, right. Rattler with the fumble, Shuck with the pick six. They not help because you got no running game. That's a big part of it. When you can't run the football, then a lot gets lapped on you. And I think Rattler was trying to hit the big play, try to move the football. Mm-hmm. If you watch the two-minute drill, that's what Shuck does best. Timing and he was precise, and it was almost the same play. It was the little slant. He kept hitting it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. The Chargers looked like, okay, and then finally, you know, as they got closer to the goal line, it sort of stalled out, but you did get the field goal with it. I was impressed. The one thing you can say with Chuck, man, he got a rifle. Man, mm-hmm. That thing comes out of there, and it comes out of there fast.
And on target.
And he processed the information pretty quickly. Now, all rookies go through the process. And what the texter said about Shedeur, I thought he did a great job, Sal, watching him. Mm-hmm. Man, he threw the football. He was on time. He was poised. But that could change from game to game. This is preseason. That's what preseason's all about.
And the looks that the defense has given you.
And also,
or lack thereof.
I think timing with your receivers. Mm-hmm. Because I think what really hurt Rattler is offensive line play and receivers getting separation, they all touched the play of the quarterback. Mm-hmm. he wasn't getting no help up front, and his receivers weren't exactly getting open downfield. And so you had that part of it. But I will say that Shuck played better than I thought he would, to be honest with you. And I really liked what I saw in that two-minute drill. And the one thing Bob always touched it all the time, when you got a guy wide open like Tipton, Don't just try to drill it in there. Throw it up there and let him run under it.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times, a young quarterback, man, I'm going to drill it downfield. No, put some air under it and let him run under it. He's wide open. And let him make the play, kind of catching it downfield, which is exactly what he did. But
kind
that
of running
play,
toward a kickoff to return it, right? Getting momentum going. Yeah.
Yeah, keep rolling with it. But that play worked because of the fact that the one hole open, Clyde Edwards-Helaire caught the blitzer, and it gave Tyler enough time to throw the football downfield. The other guy that really impressed me, and I liked him in college, and he's a change of position guy, and that's Velus Jones. Velus, when I scouted him, he was from Alabama. He goes to USC as a receiver, mm-hmm. played receiver there, then transferred to Tennessee, and his final season with the Volunteers, he was a good player there as a wide receiver return man. And then he got changed over after a couple of years. He was a third-round pick in 2022, and it didn't work out for him at wide receiver. Man, you can see his speed and his explosiveness when he gets a little bit of an opening. Man, he's fast with pads and a helmet on. A lot of guys, you put them on a track, they fast. Put a helmet on them and pads, and a lot of track guys don't like to get hit.
Mm-hmm.
So you put that type of deal on it. He's got a spot on this roster because, one, he can return kicks, he can play running back, and in a pinch, you could put him at wide receiver.
I'm going to tell you one thing that I think we had a second. One thing that got me about the referees yesterday is this safety thing. And in a preseason game, okay, it doesn't matter. But we need to figure out what the hell we're doing, right? I mean.
Okay, supposedly if you initiate contact before the end zone, then it's put where the ball, where you initiated contact. But, man, that's such a bang-bang play. You know, again, it didn't make a heck of a lot of difference in the long run. But I think the one thing you got out of that play is that in this new defense, Christian Boyd's got a spot.
Yep.
He's got a spot. And Jonah Williams is another guy who's a veteran. Man, he sort of bounced around the NFL. But he's a good fit in this defense. He's not going to be a starter. But he's got a part in the rotation here of defensive linemen. And you can see his technical skills, his ability to get around people and use his arms and hands. Jonah Williams is another guy that before training camp started, there wasn't a lot of people talking about Jonah Williams or Christian Boyd. You know what? They made plays yesterday. That's what preseason's about. I want to see individual play and you making plays. Both of them made plays yesterday.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. I want to talk about the new kickoff rule. I don't know if you saw the end of the Miami-Chicago game yesterday on the NFL Network. Did you or not?
No, I didn't.
There was a kickoff that lands in the end zone. Then it hits the pylon, and the player and the ref are looking at each other like, I don't know. We'll talk about that. They really were. It's like, well, I don't know. What do I do? And the ref's like, well, I don't know. 6:51, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:57, couple of minutes left with Mike DeTillier. Hey, Mike, this kickoff rule, the Miami Dolphins-Bears game yesterday, the kicker, it hits in the end zone and then like a wedge or something, like Scotty Scheffler hit it, and then it hits the pylon, and the player and the ref are looking at each other like, one looked at each other for the guidance, and it's like, I don't know. Do you understand the new kickoff rule and how it's supposed to work?
Not really. On that particular deal, my thing is, hey, just put it where it's supposed to be and we'll take it from there.
Yeah.
But, you know, they put in so many new rules now. Ian Ozan would know a lot more about it because, man, it changes all the time with it. And
because if you kick it through the end zone, it's one thing. If it lands in the end zone,
it's another.
But if it lands in the end zone and hits the pylon, I don't know if anybody ever considered that or not. Now I'm thinking these kickers are going to start kicking it like Scotty Scheffler. Like, okay, let's try to see if we can land it softly here and take a kick to the left, take a bounce to the left, you know?
Yeah, the crazy thing is that the kicking game, how much has changed. Bob and I talked about this the other day, and we saw Cam Little hit a 70-yard field goal for Jacksonville this weekend.
That's crazy.
Now, think about it, Tommy. Last year, there were 20 field goals in the NFL made from 60 yards or more. 20. From 1960 to 2018. It's a pretty good little sample size there. Almost 60 years. You know how many 60-yard-plus field goals were made?
I'm going to guess 3 or 4.
20.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, in 1 year, they made more or the same amount of field goals of 60 yards or more than they had in 58 years. It's amazing how these kickers, and none of them are really big guys.
Mm-hmm.
I man, the swing and the torque as people that golf a little bit, sometimes you go out with a golfer and a big guy, and okay, he's got a nice swing and everything, but the ball doesn't hit the green right. You got a little bitty dude, man, come in there, and he smacks it, and it's right down the green, and he's got some distance on it.
That's
what field goal kickers are doing.
I played golf with a guy that was playing football for Alabama at the time in Disney World, and I was blowing it by him 30, 40 yards every time, and it was ticking him off, man, I'm telling you. Thank you, Mike. We're listening this afternoon
from
the Silver Slipper, starting at 4 on WWL. Hot, humid, chance for showers, a little tropical wave off the coast of Africa that's expected to turn north into the Atlantic and not even affect land as I understand it. Otherwise, the tropics are quiet for the next 7 to 10 days. Here we are on August the 11th. That'll bring us to August 21st, and then we get to the peak of hurricane season. But for the next 10 days, I'll take it. That's all you can do at this time of year. Speaking of year, remember way back in 2018? Seems like only yesterday, doesn't it? Well, that was 7 years ago. And now the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget is estimating the Social Security Retirement Trust Fund is going to be insolvent in just 7 years. So if you think 2018 was just the blink of an eye ago, if you flash forward to 2032, well, there we are. Mike Murphy joins us now, Chief of Staff for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. How you doing, Mike?
I'm good, Tommy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. I just thought I'd put that in perspective because sometimes we don't realize that 7 years is not that long of a time at all.
Yeah, I mean, people think 7 years might be a long time, but I'll put it in a different perspective. 7 years from now will be when today's 60-year-olds will be reaching that normal retirement age for Social Security. So it's really not that far off. And yes, as you said, we estimated that by the time we get to 2032, Social Security, when it goes insolvent in that year, it's going to require, this is by law, Congress requires this, is when it goes insolvent, by law, they have to match scheduled benefits with revenues, and that would mean a 24% across-the-board cut for everybody on the program. So it really isn't that far off, and we need to start acting to prevent that from happening.
Wait, say that again. The federal law says what?
So the federal law says that when Social Security reaches insolvency, when it gets to the point when the revenues aren't sufficient to cover the scheduled benefits, which is what we estimate will happen by 2032. And our estimates are based on the trustees' estimates of Social Security, the actual trustees of the program. By law, Tommy, what has to happen is they have to match the benefits with the revenues that are coming in. And that's estimated to do that would require cutting benefits across the board by 24%. That would equal, we estimate, about an $18,000 benefit cut for the average typical two-earner retiree couple retiring at that time.
Now, when I hear that, I think immediately I go to the pragmatic part of it, and that ain't no congressman, senator, or House of Representatives wants to be stuck with cutting Social Security, so they'll just pass a new law to get the money from the federal treasury to make up the shortfall. However, that's going to be a ton of money, and that's going to increase the federal debt. Am I making stuff up or not?
No, you are exactly right, Tommy. Washington, it seems these days, and for quite some time now, they don't seem to act outside of a deadline. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people think, no, they're not going to act. They're just going to wait until 2032. And when they do that, yeah, they could just transfer money, is what a lot of people fear. But that's going to worsen our already unsustainable fiscal and debt situation. We got a debt situation right now that is reaching historic levels. If you measure our debt as a percentage of our economy, which is what most economists like to look at when they want to try and measure our debt levels, we're at levels we've never seen in this country. We're approaching levels we've only seen one other time, which was right around World War II, except for
what?
The world. Right now, we were borrowing to save the free world during World War II. But now we're just borrowing for our consumption. So, no, we can't just borrow from the general fund to fund Social Security. We're already unsustainable at the federal level. We can't do that.
So we're at $37 trillion right now. If they were to pass a law because they don't want to be the ones to cut Social Security benefits, how much would that cost the United States government? Do you have any idea?
We don't have the estimates on that, but it would be trillions of dollars of additional unfunded liabilities
every year
that are on the books. Right.
Every year.
I mean, for in perpetuity because of the amount of those Social Security. Social Security is the largest federal program in the budget. But you know what, Tommy, what the second largest line item in the budget is interest costs on our national debt. Interest costs are the second biggest line item in the budget. We spend more on interest costs on our national debt now at the federal level than we do on defense in a given year, or Medicare. So that just puts in perspective how large some of these fiscal challenges are.
Again, I'm looking at it politically, not financially. You're talking about conservatively $2 trillion a year if the government were to make up the 24%?
It's a little bit more complicated than that because it's more of an accounting,
all right, let's say
accounting
a trillion.
Issue than that.
A trillion?
Yeah. I mean, it's over a trillion, but it's because it's actually not going to have to be the full gap. So when I said before that you're going to have to cut Social Security by 24%, that's the gap, right? So it's not the entire gap of the program. It's not going completely bankrupt. They're still going to have, you know.
No, I get that, but I'm just saying the
76%.
If they were going to politically punt it and just increase the federal debt for people that think that's an option, because it seems to me that we have two trains here, Mike, that are running at about a 45-degree angle, and eventually they're going to hit each other. Accurate?
Yeah, I would say that's accurate.
Social Security.
That's exactly right. I'll put another number on it, Tom, and just try to put this in perspective for you and your listeners. So to get our debt under control, a lot of people think what you need to do is balance the budget. Balance the budget's actually a very difficult goal to reach right now, given the size of our deficits and require huge amounts of savings. What you actually need to do is take your debt levels and level them out so they're not growing faster than your economy. Our debt's growing faster than our economy right now, which is what makes it unsustainable. If you want to level that off, you have to achieve about $10 trillion or so in savings over 10 years. Now, to put that in perspective, the federal government's projected to spend about $90 trillion over the next 10 years. So $10 trillion sounds like a ton, but in the context of a massive budget that spends $7 trillion annually right now and is going to grow, it's not as much. So that puts some of this in perspective numbers-wise, but it's a big task, and we got to get our leaders working together to start to solve it.
Now, let me take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about what's going to actually look like to people, especially here in Louisiana, if that happens. 721, we're talking about Social Security. If nothing changes, it's going to be insolvent and require across-the-board cuts in about 7 years, and it's going to hit Louisiana people hard. We'll drill down on that when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 727, Tommy Tucker, WWO, Mike Murphy, our guest, Chief of Staff for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, trying to tell the truth about Social Security.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great. But it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going. Whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby, Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
Security by law, all beneficiaries are subject to a 24% benefit cut, about a quarter, equal to about $18,100 annually for an average couple if they don't fix it. So, along those lines, Mike, what would it look like for the people specifically in Louisiana, and how would they fix it?
So, first, Tommy, just to put this more broadly in perspective about Social Security, it's important to remind people how important Social Security is to the American public. It serves 67 million people in the country. Currently, around 785,000 folks in Louisiana receive retirement benefits annually from Social Security. Nationally, over 40% of people rely on Social Security for a majority of their income in retirement. So it is vitally important to kind of put that impending financial problems in context. And so to build on that in more details in Louisiana, our estimates are we projected how many recipients will be on Social Security within the 7 years when it goes insolvent. And we estimate that there'll be about 900,000 Louisianans subject to the risk of that 24% across the board cut. So this is significant and this is serious.
So how did they fix it?
That's the thing about Social Security, Tommy. There's been people that have been studying Social Security and kind of known that this insolvency date's been coming for a long time. And so therefore there's lots of different potential policy ideas and options on the table. They're not easy. Then, Social Security is the so-called third rail, but they're out there. And so, for example, and you have to look at both sides, okay, both sides of the ledger. On the revenue side, believe it or not, and this is actually an idea that Republicans as well have been talking about sometimes, is most people are probably aware that right now Social Security, you stop paying contributions on the taxes when you reach a certain income threshold. It's set right now at around $176,000 annually. And so you stop paying taxes when you get to that level each year. And so there's discussions and policy ideas surrounding how do you adjust that cap. That cap hasn't really been adjusted for the overall level of wages in the economy in decades. So on the revenue side, that's one option that's often talked about. On the benefit side, there's ideas to prospectively adjust benefits for the realities of the economy. The idea of adjusting the retirement age prospectively in the future, very slowly. So a couple decades from now, raise the age by a month or two every year or two, and that can go a long way. Adjusting benefits so they're a little bit more progressive, so people at the low end actually get more than they're scheduled to get, and people at the very high end of the income spectrum still receive Social Security. We're certainly not going to means test it or take it away, but they might receive less than they're scheduled to get today, just to make it a little bit more progressive. You do some of these things, make it more progressive, adjust some of the revenue, adjust the age, do a few more things, and you can solve Social Security for generations. But it's difficult. Those aren't easy ideas. It just takes political will.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Chief of Staff for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. If you care, you should contact your elected representative and tell them you care. Coming up, I'm excited about this new segment, Bank On It, Financial Insights You Can Count On with Jason Shields, Chief Operating Officer, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust Company. We're going to talk about getting you ready for hurricane season when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Man, I'm excited about this new segment, Bank On It, Financial Insights You Can Count On with Jason Shields, our friend, Chief Operating Officer for Gulf Coast, Bank and Trust Company. How you doing, Jason?
I'm doing good, Tommy. How are you?
I am okay. Did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, not too bad. Football's back,
You got that right.
Yeah.
It's also hurricane season, though, and I think we're going to talk about people getting ready for hurricane season, right, financially?
Absolutely. So this morning I wanted to cover a couple things people could do now that could have huge financial impacts as hurricane season comes about. With back to school and football going on, the last thing people want to think about is, do I have proper insurance coverage or anything? But if you take a couple of minutes right now, before the storm season starts to pick up, you can actually make sure that you can know where you stand from a financial standpoint, I guess, is the point. So one of the first things I think everyone should do, and this is always good to do on an annual basis, is to check your hazard insurance policies. Make sure, do you have the right amount of coverage? Are you sure what your deductible is? We've seen, especially with the cost of insurance going up lately and people trying to renegotiate their insurance, very large deductibles, up to 10%+. And while that may get you the premium that you're looking for, you may not realize the impacts that is going to have if an actual event occurs. If your house is worth $300,000 and you have a 10% deductible, that's $30,000 you have to come up with. And I don't know about you, Tommy, but I don't just have large piles of money sitting around. That's what I count on my insurance to do.
Well,
so
let's not talk about what I got going on in my house. Jason, I got close to 30 bucks hanging around, just sitting around.
Hey, yeah, not bad.
No, but you make a good point, because people don't realize that what sounds like a good deductible now, when you need that insurance and you need to make a claim, guess what? It's going to be an unpleasant surprise.
It is. And it's kind of an unfortunate effect of the increase in the price of insurance down here in South Louisiana, that we've gotten these larger deductibles. And that's okay. As long as you're aware of what your deductible is and where you stand, then you won't be shocked in the unfortunate event if something were to happen. Another thing that I like to remind people to check is, do they have what's called replacement cost value or actual cost value? Because let's just say your roof is 10 years old. Your insurance company, if you have an actual cost value policy, gives you the depreciated price of that roof to replace it, not the full cost. And that can hit you pretty hard, right? Mm-hmm. So, again, not necessarily something that's bad. Just pull your policy, maybe have a conversation with your agent, and just understand where you stand so that if something were to happen, your savings aren't taking that hit that you weren't expecting.
I think that's good advice, because, again, it seems like a good deal at the time until you go to make a claim. Then it's like, what?
Mm-hmm. Agreed. So the last thing, and I think most people down here that have been here for a while are familiar with this, but make sure you have wind and hail coverage. It's obviously separate from your general hazard in most policies these days, and that deductible tends to be the nasty one. So just, again, pull the policies and make sure. And then the last thing I'll say about hazard insurance, but I think this is a big one, is most companies will not write a policy. They won't bind a policy once the name storms in the Gulf. So now is the time, if you don't have insurance or if you want to make changes, you want to go ahead and get that started now before if something were to appear in the Gulf.
And although flood insurance has gone up, that's a pretty important thing to have, is it not?
100% agree. You know, Flood 2.0 has made it an interesting time as far as what your insurance could cost and trying to figure that out. The old letter zones aren't what they used to be. It used to be relatively simple. But yes, and the other thing about flood insurance that everyone should remember is there's a 30-day waiting period for new policies. If you're not buying your house or if you're not doing an event where you're acquiring the piece of property, you have to wait 30 days. So if you want flood insurance and you want it to be in effect for the peak of hurricane season, now's the time to have those conversations with your agents as well.
How about some other ideas for hurricane season, Jason?
Yeah, so this one should go without saying, but a lot of people don't think about it, is emergency cash. And while we all don't have a bunch of spare cash lying around, I think it's important to have a few hundred dollars in small bills around in the event of a storm that should come in, because when you come back, yes, banks are important infrastructure and will be open as quickly as possible, but I'm pretty sure your first thing you want to do after coming back from a storm is not try to go through debris and try to make your way to the bank, right? You want to just have cash available. And a lot of people say, well, generators nowadays have fixed that. And while the generators are good and we will have power and hopefully air conditioning, the internet lines may be broken. And if the internet lines are broken, that kind of disrupts anyone's ability to swipe a debit card or do anything else. So you just want to have a little bit of cash to make sure that you can mobilize if you're in the event you come back after the storm. And, you know, pro tip is, of course, to just deposit those funds back into your account after, because we all want to earn interest on it. Mm-hmm. But just keep it handy for the storm season.
Well, credit cards.
And then, credit cards. This is a good one, Tommy, because I don't think this is one everyone thinks about. Everyone likes to say they have an emergency credit card, and that's good. But down here in the South during hurricane season, I think it's important that you should have at least two methods of payment. The worst thing that could happen to you is you have that one emergency card, you never use it, and then when you go to pull it out, it gets shut down for a fraud alert or something like that, right? So as general practice, I say have multiple methods of payment available to handle whatever it is that would occur.
What about debit cards? Debit cards, Jason, what about those?
Yeah, no, debit cards are good. And, you know, they rely on those lines, those internet lines that I talked about, right? So you just want to make sure that my general approach is I have a debit card and I have a credit card. When I'm doing evacuations, hotels and things like that, always use a credit card, right? Because, you know, they put those big holds. And so you don't want to evacuate to a hotel and then have someone tie up all your money in your checking account with a debit card that a hold gets put on it for some reason. So
would you want more than one debit card at a different institution or not?
Well, you know, as a banker, I'm, of course, going to say I always want you to have one at my institution.
Absolutely.
But yes, Yes, you should have multiple debit cards.
But you could look at it the other way, that if you have one and you're not a Gulf Coast customer now, you need to get one with Gulf Coast, right?
Hey, I would invite anyone who wants to come see us. Personal service. We have personalized cards that they might find. Very nice.
Did I hear something about a high school card you guys have?
So we have teamed up with a lot of local high schools. Tommy, I think I mentioned to you, we have a Shaw card, right? So right. I'll have one of those sent over to you recently, but also, you know, lots of the other local schools, and we're trying to increase that as well. So if anyone wants to go see which schools we currently have, you can go to our website, golfbank.com, and check it out. And then the cool thing about those, Tommy, is they're instantly issued at the branch. So you sit down, you talk to the banker for a few minutes about things. Maybe we go over your insurance policies with you. And we print these cards out in about 2 minutes.
That's awesome.
And you take it home.
Tell me how you got to be COO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. And everybody's got a story. Is that what you wanted to be when you were a kid or not?
Does anyone actually grow up and say, I want to be a banker? So
you know what? I've asked that question of a lot of people, and sometimes they say, yes, that's what they wanted to do.
So, you know, I was going to UNL, right? In college, being a banker is the greatest the job that you can have when you're in school, right? Because it's great hours. You get the holidays off. It syncs up with school. So that's how it started, and I've never looked back. So I love it. I love what we do for the community, and I would have no other job.
Sounds like you do love it. Thank you, Jason. Some very valuable information. Another success story from UNO as well. Jason Shields, Chief Operating Officer of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. The website again, Jason?
GulfBank.com.
Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you next Monday. Bank on it. Financial insights you can count on with Jason Shields, Chief Operating Officer, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust Company. 7:54 and a half. Time now for traffic on WWL. Yeah, but I'm not alone. We got Jordan Fiegel producing from an unknown location. Tim Zimmer manning master control. Tim, bring the music up. Take a bow. Ian Ozan with the news. You got Joe Cardosi with the traffic. Diane Newman, everybody else helping us out. Dan Barron. So it's a team effort, and we appreciate you listening. We really do. Part of that team, Jeff Palermo, who is a WWL.com columnist and director of the Louisiana News Network. How you doing, Jeffrey?
Oh, I'm doing well, Tommy. How's things with you? Good weekend?
I did have a good weekend. Got a lot done, but I got to tell you, I'm a little tired. But that happens, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about these.
It does happen.
Tell me about. Oh, by the way, I've been working on an impersonation of Brian Kelly.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And this is Brian Kelly when he sees somebody on the field that's not supposed to be there, and it goes something like this. Brian says, "What's that guy doing? Hey, get off the field! You're not supposed. Why is he out? Why is that guy? Get it! You're not supposed to. Why is he out there? What's going on? Why is that guy? Hey, get off the field! Can't you imagine the coach doing that?
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I can see that with
that. That sounds exactly to me like Brian Kelly when somebody's on the field. He's turning for guidance while at the same time telling a guy to get the hell off the field.
Yeah, right.
Let's talk about, I guess, the news with LSU and the legal problems. Let's start with that, I guess.
Well, yeah, very tough story that broke on Friday, really, on many fronts. One, you have going back to May, a fatal shooting where a teenager lost her life. I mean, that's kind of, that's where this starts, and you have to remember that. But the football ramifications of this is that JT Lindsey knew these two individuals that are suspected in the murder of this teenager back in Alexandria. And according to authorities, for a couple of weeks, JT Lindsey allowed these two individuals, while they were on the run from police, he allowed them to stay at his dorm, his apartment-style dorm. And when authorities eventually tracked these two individuals down, not only were they able to find them, but they found guns inside the dorm, and just not a good situation at all for a young man to be involved in, someone that's got such a promising future. Now, JT Lindsey, through his attorney, says that, hey, I didn't know that these two individuals were wanted for murder. I was just, you know, letting them stay at my place. But for right now, the police are not buying that story, and we'll have to wait for the courts to decide, you know, what will happen. But as we know, this is not going to get resolved very quickly, so it's likely that JT Lindsey will not play for LSU this season since he is charged with a felony, and it's LSU will not allow student athletes to participate if they're facing felony criminal charges. So Lindsey's going to have to patiently wait and for his day in the court. Meanwhile, LSU football's got to move on. Mm-hmm. But now they only have three scholarship running backs. And so you're very thin there. And it's a very physical position, Tommy. And, you know, one of those three guys are going to get hurt. So at one point, you're going to be down to two scholarship players. And so they got to figure out ways to try to build a little depth there. Juwan Johnson's someone that even before this happened with JT Lindsey, they had him running some plays from the running back position. Juwan Johnson's listed as a quarterback on the roster. And then you got Jelani Watkins, who might be the fastest guy in college football as a receiver, but maybe they can make him a running back or at least have him line up in the backfield every now and then. So tough situation, very difficult, and it's just I don't know what the word is for it, Tommy, but it's to have this happen twice now basically to LSU, two great high school football running backs from the state of Louisiana come to their school and both end up facing some very serious charges and now unable to play. It's a tough situation all the way around. For the football team, for the players, for the families involved in these acts, whether the players were involved in them or not, it's just very, very tough all the way around.
All right, let me take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about your story that you have posted at WWL.com about the other player. If it seems like deja vu, it's not, and I'm talking about Trey Holly. We'll go into that when we return with our guest, Jeff Palermo, WWL.com, Louisiana Network News Director. Right now we pause for traffic on WWL. 826 and a half, talking to Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist and Louisiana Network News Director. I got Ryan Clark coming up. I'm looking forward to that. Jeff, in the 9 o'clock hour, he's got a thing on ESPN about Katrina and so forth, a former Shaw Eagle, I'll mention. Let's talk about Trey Holly and the problems that he has, because he's not, I don't think he's in jail, is he?
No, he's not in jail. In fact, he's with the Southern University football team, and he's going to play for the Jaguars this season. Of course, his situation dates back to February of 2024. There was a shooting at an apartment complex where Trey Holly happened to be present. Two people were injured in that shooting. Initially, Trey Holly faced some very serious charges. Those charges eventually were reduced, but he still faces felony charges, basically gun charges, in this shooting that injured two people. And Trey Holly has been pretty adamant on social media that he is innocent of the charges. Now, he didn't play at all last season, again, because he was facing felony charges, not allowed to play at LSU. So he sat out, and then he was supposed to have his trial in July, but at the Union Parish Courthouse, they had to replace the entire air conditioning unit, and his trial got postponed and has yet to be rescheduled. And so he didn't want to sit out another year, so Southern was willing to happy to have him come on the team, have him basically, he's on as a walk-on. I don't think he's a scholarship running back, and I wouldn't be surprised if he has a really good season for the Jaguars. He's an outstanding football player, but and again, I don't know if Trey's guilty of the charges that he's facing. It's just, again, a very unfortunate circumstance that you have someone that had a very, very promising future and then ends up in, seeing his life get sidetracked. And, we'll see what happens with him at Southern, and then we'll eventually have to wait and see what happens with the criminal charges he's facing. But it's a very difficult situation, again, for everyone involved.
So what does that mean for the running back position for LSU, quickly, in the minute we have left?
Well, it just means that they are really thin. You know, they had an opportunity to bring John Emery back for another season, which would have been a seventh season, but LSU decided to move on, and I understand that. But they're in a tough situation. You really have just one running back that you feel really good about as a guy that can perform on the SEC level. That's Caden Durham. Caleb Jackson is his backup, and Caleb has yet to really show that he's a guy that you can count on. Now, they're hoping they can get that out of him. He's a junior. He needs to step up into that role, and now more than ever. And then you got Trey Holly, who is the number one high school running back prospect in the country. But this was a guy that and he's a terrific football player, a lot of fun to watch when he was at St. Martin's in Episcopal, but he was playing small school high school football. And now can he make this huge jump to the SEC? And that remains to be seen. So they're in a tough spot when there's all this talk about, you know, trying to run the football better. And, you know, you're one injury away now from really being in a tough situation if one of those three scholarship running backs go down.
You said, I'm not calling you out or anything, but just to be clear, you said Trey Holly. You're talking about Harlan Berry, right?
I mean Harlan Berry. Right, Harlan Berry. Excuse me.
That's all right.
Thank you for correcting me.
Well,
thank you. Harlan Berry.
Yeah. Correcting you. Just to help.
Yeah, no. It needed to be corrected.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Have a good day.
All right, you too, sir. Thank you. Appreciate it as always. Maybe next time we can actually talk about football and not legal proceedings. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Michael Hecht about the cost of living in New Orleans and more right now. Time for WWL First News. So that would go to Ian Ozan. 8:46, 14 till 9. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend Michael Hecht, who is normally on with Newell, the president and CEO of GNO Inc. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing great, Tommy. It's great to be abnormally on with you.
Well, I don't know what that means, but I appreciate it. I'll tell you this. I saw that you were I've seen you already MC when they roasted Newell Norman, and I've seen you moderate a mayoral forum, and I'm thinking that you might just make a good game show host. Have you looked into it?
I've been told that before. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a compliment, but I've been told
it
that
is.
Before.
So you should think of it as a compliment. Really?
Thank you.
Man, look, let me tell you, I've told this story before. All I ever wanted to do when I was a kid, I mean like 10 years old, was be a game show host because I knew they worked one day a week. They taped five shows. They wore nice clothes, and they hung out with pretty women. And that seemed like the ideal life to me. Didn't quite pan out.
And they're kind of funny. Yeah, and I do kind of miss the old days of the game shows, like with like the dating game where you were kind of given a little more latitude, right?
Tom Kennedy was a great guy, one of the game shows hosts. But that's not what you're here to talk about. I'm seeing this story by our friend Stephanie Regal at NOLA.com talking about the affordability of living in New Orleans, and one of the co-founders of Idea Village saying that sounding the alarm, if you will, and saying that people that are trying to build in New Orleans, math doesn't work. Housing costs, sky-high insurance rates, school tuition, infrastructure issues, making entrepreneurship financially impossible in practice. Unless we do something, we're going to lose the very people who make this city's future worth investing in. That had to have gotten your attention, Michael Hecht.
Yeah, it did. It's something that we've been wrestling with, frankly, since Katrina, and I think there's some really good points that are raised in the story. When someone is deciding where they want to live and raise their family, let alone start a company, there are a number of factors that are being considered. There's the overall economy and job opportunity. There's the affordability issue, which you just touched on a number of the most critical items now: home insurance, auto insurance, school tuition. There's quality of life, which involves things like public safety, where we've gotten much better recently, but we still have issues with flooding from rain, for example. And then finally, a part about it that doesn't get spoken about enough, Tommy, that I think is important is that you need to have people believing in a vision of where the city is going. What's the future? Why are we all doing this? And if those things don't come together in the right balance, and it is a balance because there's some places that are much more expensive than New Orleans that are growing, mm-hmm. So it's about the balance of those factors, then I think it's something even more simple than affordability. I think people are asking, just in a broader sense, is it worth it?
So how do you go about convincing people that it is worth it and making it worth it?
not with words, with actions. Mm-hmm. And the good news is that we know how to do this. It's been done in other places. In Minneapolis, they brought down housing prices 17%. There was a big article on New Rochelle, a suburb from New York that people are flocking to, about how they've been encouraging building. It's some basic stuff, and a lot of it doesn't cost a lot of money, Tommy. It's fixing zoning so you can have more housing density. It's giving incentives to developers. We have something like 20,000 housing units that are currently not on the market. Let's get them fixed up and get them into the market by giving small incentives to developers that will make back in property taxes later on to get them developed. It's also about transportation. We're an interesting place, Tommy, in that despite being small, we think about ourselves as just New Orleans and not the region. Mm-hmm. Very few other places do that, but we need better public transportation to get people from less expensive places to live into the urban core. And unfortunately, we've gone backwards in that over the past few years. So there are a number of things you can do, and collectively, they will tend to bring costs down, even as there's some issues like insurance that we're trying to deal with at the national level.
Do you think the elected officials are aware of this and are willing to do whatever it takes to make this happen?
The good news, and I got this, the mayoral forum that I was able to moderate the other night was actually on real estate. So we spoke about this a lot. And I think that all of the major candidates seem to recognize the issue. And I would even say it's a crisis, and are committed to practical steps to getting it fixed, whether it's the things that we just talked about or some mitigation methods like increasing our number of fortified roofs to reduce exposure and bring down insurance costs. I think the good news is that all of the candidates seem to agree that the ultimate measure of success of a city or region or a state is population. If it's growing, you're winning. If it's not growing, then you've got challenges. And so, you know, Tommy, it's kind of like when you or me go to therapy. The first thing you have to do is admit you have a problem. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that we're having this reckoning going into a new election and potentially a fresh 8 years is timely, and I'm actually very encouraged because there's an enormous amount of good things going on. We've got Charity Hospital coming online. We've got the River District that's getting built. We're finally redeveloping the NSA. My Lord, we might even save Plaza Tower. Mm-hmm. Tourism numbers are very strong. Our tech industry is doing very strong. Energy is booming throughout the state. We just got millions and secured the future of NASA MISU. So it's not as if all is bleak. Just going back to what I said at the beginning, I guess, Tommy, we just have to get it all back in balance.
So you're talking about Plaza Tower. That is with or without the hairnet, as you once so eloquently put it.
Well, I would encourage everybody to take a picture of the hairnet because it's going to come down at some point and nobody's going to believe you.
That's a good point. Let me ask you this real quick about it seems to me, and I've been here all my life, that sometimes we get stuck in trying to preserve the past so much that we lose sight of the future and it holds us way back. And I'm not saying I want New Orleans to be anywhere USA, but is that part of the problem, Michael?
I think it can be part of the problem in two ways. And of course, you know, we don't want to ruin what makes New Orleans unique, but we have to realize that when we have an affordability crisis, those very people who create the culture that everybody loves are forced to move. So actually, being forward-thinking is actually about preserving the past in a way. I think we saw, Tommy, during the Super Bowl that we can be utterly unique but also be a safe, accessible, lovely, modern city. So I think we have to lean into the future a little bit and make sure that we don't settle for mediocrity, which I think sometimes, unfortunately, we might do.
Thank you, Michael. When are you on with Noel again?
This Wednesday, if he has me. It's always a bit touch and go until the end, but if they don't have another guest lined up, they usually let me on.
And what is this about you and me go to therapy? What makes you think I go to therapy? Have we seen each other at the same office or not? Just kidding.
No, of course not. Of course not. That must have been somebody who looked and sounded like you in the baseball cap.
Probably what it was with the sunglasses. Hey, thank you, Michael. I appreciate it. Have a good day. Michael,
thanks, Tommy. Have a great day. Great week.
Thank you, sir. You too. President and CEO of GNO Inc. We're going to take a break for traffic. Next hour, we'll talk to Ryan Clark, former LSU Tiger, 13 years in the NFL with the Washington Redskins. The Giants, spent most of his time with the Pittsburgh Steelers. Of course, a graduate of LSU, but to me, he'll always be a Shaw Eagle. 8:55 now, time for traffic on WWL. So, who is that? Peyton Malone?
Someone from Michigan?
Bruh. That's Francis McNorman from Fargo as the sheriff.
We did this one tango. Marge. Fargo. Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of that accent, I guess.
Yeah, all right.
I don't know.
Okay.
I really don't.
You like movies or not, do you?
I'm not the biggest movie guy, no. Really? I wouldn't say I'm an expert. I like movies, but I don't know much.
So what, what do you like to do to watch? What do you, have you been watching
on
video?
I do a lot of nowadays? I listen to podcasts.
Do you?
I just any podcast.
Do you listen while you're typing and get half of it like you did with me?
It's exactly what happens.
Good for you. Good for you. Multitask. I like it. Let's talk about what's going on with the hurricane season and the Atlantic and the Gulf and blah, 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 blah.
Blah, blah, blah. I know. And we're just in the beginning of it. You know, August into September, things ramp up. By the way, they're just named Tropical Storm Erin. They're going to pull that advisory here in the next couple of minutes.
E-R-I-N or?
E-R-I-N.
All right. Where is she?
Well, she's a couple hundred miles off the coast of Africa. That's how far away it is. So this is not going to be a threat to anybody anytime soon. I'm looking at the data here. It's just looking like it's not a Gulf system. As curving out to sea seems like a pretty good scenario with this one.
That's what I saw before. You know, I mean, you never know because, and Lord knows, you know a lot more than I do. But it looked like this is going to take a northeasterly turn and just kind of affect the ships at sea and maybe eventually Ireland or something.
Yeah, and hopefully that's what it does. You know, we always talk about this thing is so far out there, and I have seen where we've had storms that look like they were going to do the exact same thing, and boy, they did the opposite. And so we do have to watch these things closely, but things are encouraging, at least with what we're seeing right now. So we've got solid 7 to 10 days to just watch it unfold.
That's what I love. You know, I take it 10 days at a time. So if you can give me the all clear, but wait, that's just the all clear in terms of formation until the 21st, or in terms of anything threatening us?
Anything threatening the U.S. Okay. would be beyond, that 7 to 10 days.
So what could happen in the next 10 days that you don't see now that could affect us? Where would it have to form?
Well, it's not about where it's forming. It's more so about how strong this ridge is, this blocking high. Mm-hmm. That's what's sending it west right now. We think the ridge is going to weaken by about Saturday and Sunday.
Wait, sending what west?
The storm, Erin.
Okay.
It's currently heading west. It's going to stay heading west all week long, really. Now, it's going to start to turn north as we head into the weekend, and if that ridge is weak enough, then it continues to turn north and go out to sea. If that ridge ends up being a little stronger, the trough, the timing is all, it's all about timing, right? And so if the timing's just a little off, then you've got a system that's sneaking a little further west here. And so that's the uncertainty of it, is just when does that turn happen and how quickly does it happen?
So did I hear you say something earlier about some kind of not tropical system, but something going on that would bring us more moisture?
Yeah. In the Gulf, we've got this big old...
See, I listened, Peyton. I wasn't typing. I was listening what you're saying.
Well, you know, I got a lot going on now. And so this moisture in the Eastern Gulf, it's going to be slowly moving our way. We don't think it's going to develop into anything. It'll just bring us some extra showers. The showers that do happen between today, tomorrow, and Wednesday will have the potential to be on the heavy side. But, I'm not sure the flood risk is any higher than it normally is this time of year.
So pretty much...
Routine
summertime, right?
I think so, yeah. And it'll probably be a few more storms than what we typically see on an afternoon, but... You know, it's just one of those. If you get stuck under one, watch out for the street flooding. If you don't get it, it's just hot and humid.
It seems as though to me, and just being outside a lot, that it was brutally hot at the latter parts of July.
Yeah.
And then now it seems as though over the weekend, although hot, it's not that bone-breaking hot. Something happened or what?
Yeah, we had a big ridge was over us during the end of July when we were topping out in the mid to upper 90s. That ridge has really weakened quite a bit, and so that's why it's been rainier, but also it hasn't been as hot. Temperatures have been topping out mostly in the low 90s with some showers around.
I'm going to tell you what, people are going to say I'm crazy, but I was out playing tennis with Grady the dog yesterday, part of the Dog Tennis Association, DTA. You can watch it on ESPN if you like. And it actually felt, and don't call me crazy, but it actually at least reminded you that fall is coming.
You know, it's funny how we notice the most subtle changes in the weather down here because you're looking for any relief. I noticed it, too, this weekend. We were out for Dirty Linen Night, and even Red Dress Run in the shade, you know, it wasn't cool, but it's certainly been worse. And so highs in the low 90s, heat index in the low 100s, that's not terrible for us. I mean, a heat index in the 110s, you really start to feel it.
But. Well, and if you get over some, you know, you get some cloud cover, and you, I was outside yesterday with the fan blowing on me, it felt nice. It really did, actually.
Yeah, the key is the breeze. Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to find that in the city. So.
Well, you get a big enough fan from Home Depot, you'll feel the breeze, believe me.
So, it's a swamp cooler.
Yes. Tell me about the reliability of, or the importance, if you will, and I just like to always stress this information. Everybody wants to be a meteorologist today, yeah. Right? If you have a phone, you're a meteorologist. If you have a phone, you're a scientist. If you have a phone, you're a foreign policy expert. And everybody's entitled to their opinions. But I just hate people to get on social media and start spreading rumors and getting people worried for nothing. Talk about the importance of what it is that you all do over there, Peyton, and how much science and I guess, material and research and everything else and machines are behind it and computers and everything.
Sure. I mean, computers are one of the most important things to our job nowadays, modeling. It's crazy how far we have come with our ability to forecast. I know people don't think that, but the details we can spit out nowadays that you couldn't 10, 20, 30 years ago has really come a long ways. You know, it's one thing to look at weather models, which everyone has the right and access to. And I encourage, you know, it's interesting if you like looking at weather models, but models are just tools we use to create the forecast. I always say models are not the forecast. And models are always wrong. Mm. Are they ever perfectly right? Not really. And so whenever I'm looking at these models, like right now I'm looking at the European model, I'm looking at the GFS American model, you're trying to figure out why they're showing what they're showing, and is it accurate what they're showing? Is it believable what they're showing? Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things we're doing as forecasts is we're not just looking at the models and putting, okay, model shows that, that's the forecast. No, you have to sit here and go, do I believe that? Do I believe this is going to be a hurricane by Friday north of Puerto Rico? Yeah, I really do. And it's based on all the other factors of the atmosphere, but it's just one of those things. It's important that in today's age where anybody can be an expert, mm-hmm. as you said, on the internet, make sure that the information seems reliable. I guess I know it's hard to do, and the thing that's scariest is always going to grab your attention. But remember, most of the time, that's not what's going to happen. I mean,
a question that pops up on the text line here, and I think it's an important one: why the discrepancy between the models? Because you talk about, you know, people. It's such a subjective thing. Sometimes they have these models that are literally spaghetti going all over the place. That's what they call them. And then they latch onto the one that they want to believe or the narrative that they want to push. Why such a discrepancy in the models?
Well, models are trying to depict what the atmosphere is doing, and the atmosphere is constantly moving, and it's all tied to each other. And these models are using billions, if not trillions, of math equations to determine what the atmosphere is going to do. Meteorology is all math. I have a math bio. I mean, it's just what it's physics, all of it. And so it's hard to forecast the future, and it's hard to forecast something as fluid, literally, as meteorology, where everything is moving. I mean, trying to, you know, send a rocket to the moon is a billion times easier than trying to forecast if a hurricane's where it's going to go at the end of its life here in 10 days. I mean, there's just too many moving parts. The equations are unreal. Now,
you know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports. Other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great. But it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going. Whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby, Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
It's interesting because it's using less, you know, of the math finding equations, and it's looking at the history of the atmosphere and what it's done in the past. And so it's been interesting to see how the AI models are doing with all of this. They have pros and cons. Sometimes they seem to struggle a bit.
But all they can do is crunch more numbers quickly. All AI can do is crunch more numbers and run more scenarios more quickly, right?
Well, yeah, they're definitely running the scenarios, but they're less involved with the math equations and more involved with what happens in the past or what has happened in the past. They're learning from past weather events. So they're learning what happened when the atmosphere was in this state and things like that. And so it's just another tool in the toolbox we use to create a forecast. Doesn't mean, you know, everyone's always like, what's the best model to use? And I'm like, well, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. They all have problems. And it just depends on certain storms do better. Some models do better with other storms. And so,
and somebody wants to know specifically about European and U.S. tracking. Why is that different? Or is it just because of what models? I don't understand.
Yeah, well, they're talking about the different models. The GFS is the American model that mm-hmm. we use, and the European model is the European model. And they're both just our two big tools we use to forecast these
Wait,
types of
if
things.
There's only two, why do they have 1,000 lines on the screen?
Well, they use things called ensembles, and so the GFS will run 31 different scenarios. And this is where you get some of your spaghetti models. Mm-hmm. It's 31 different scenarios with a little bit of something changed in each one to try to understand the uncertainty.
If this, yep. then that, if that.
And we do that for the European, which has run 51 different scenarios. Mm. And so you can see the percentage on what's more likely than the other. And that's where you can get rid of some of those extreme outliers. That just don't make sense.
Yeah, so Peyton Malone, WWL Louisiana Forecaster, is there one that you rely on that you say, you know what, this one, for the most part, pretty good?
You know, I use them both equally, all okay. of them, honestly. Now, there's a couple you know not to use for tropics. The NAM is a good example. If you ever see someone sharing the NAM about the tropics, mm-hmm. you know they don't know what they're talking about.
What does that mean?
Well, the NAM, it's a special model. It struggles with the heat flux and how the ocean interacts with tropical systems. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes when you look at the NAM, it has every hurricane being a category 5. And so you just know it's not doing it. I mean, it has record-breaking hurricanes every time it runs this time of year. And so you just know it's not a tool to use. And it's great in the winter. It does great with cold fronts, but it doesn't do good with hurricanes. So use it in the winter, not this drop.
I know the answer to this. I'm going to ask you anyway. Why are all invests numbered in the 90s, not 58, 33, or 16? I know the answer. Do you want me to say it, or do you want
to
tell
me? What is the answer?
The answer is because it has to do with the longitude, right? Lines or the latitude?
I don't think so.
Really?
I think it's just the nine that they number from 90 to 99, right? Just a way to keep them organized. Oh, you know why they do the nines? Because they don't want any lower numbers. Now you're getting. See, I'm going through my brain.
Peyton Malone, I hate to call you out on this, but I'm pretty sure it has to do with longitude. No?
No.
Really?
Because the 9 through 99 is just a way to keep their disturbances numbered. Whenever you start to get into the lower numbers, I mean, you start to get like Tropical Depression 21, Tropical Depression 22. And so they don't want to use any of those lower numbers mm-hmm. for that to confuse people. And then the L at the end of it, like 97L, is because the L stands for the Atlantic Basin. So each basin will have like Invest 99A. That'll be a different basin. It'll be like the Pacific, or you have the Indian Ocean, all those types of things.
Oh, well, that may be, but I knew who Francis McNormand was, by God, and I knew it was from Fargo. Of course, that might be because I put
now.
It together.
Yeah.
Real quick, how far ahead can we look? Like, you know, I talk about 10 days at a time. Is there any way to look ahead through August, at least early September, and see the likelihood of something forming or not?
Yeah, we look at some global patterns, what's mm-hmm. going on a global scale, less fine details like timing and actual storm location. The Atlantic looks favorable through the third week.
Wait, favorable
of August this
for development
year.
Or
for
favorable?
For development, yeah. Okay, favorable
well,
for development.
Good. That's so, unfavorable for us.
Yeah, you got. And see, that's the confusing part. Who am I talking to? The Atlantic or you? And mm-hmm. so. For tropical systems, it looks
favorable.
Doesn't
matter. You're typing at the same time, not listening to either one of us. But anyway, go ahead. Finish your thought. What was it?
Well, I just think the Atlantic looks more favorable through the third week of August. I don't think Aaron is going to be the last storm in the next few weeks that we're tracking out that way. It does look like we'll probably see a couple more spit out. Where they go long term, well, you know, we don't know. But don't be shocked. I mean, it's August after all. This isn't shocking.
We all want you to tell us everything's going to be fine all the way through. We don't have to worry. But nobody can do that.
Well, I could tell you that.
Yeah, it's not true, but you can tell us that. Real quick, do we know anything about winter yet with La Nina, El Nino, any of that? Wetter, drier, cooler?
No. You know, down here it's one of those things that the signal's a lot less obvious, I guess you could say. But we're somewhat of in a neutral phase right now. El Nino, La Nina, we often talk about that in hurricane season. For us, we're in more of that kind of neutral phase, which is a split between the two. So,
hard to believe it ever snowed, huh?
Isn't that something? I think about that often.
I think
about how magical that was.
It was.
That was. I don't think I'll ever experience anything as cool as that in my life.
I don't think I will either. And just I look back at pictures every now and then of the and walking downtown with the snow drifts up against the building and everything. It's hard to believe, especially on a day like this.
Shoveling snow off my balcony.
Exactly. There you go.
What? I thought I was going to collapse. So it didn't.
Wait, you're the balcony.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was typing. I didn't hear. Thank you, Peyton Malone. Have a great day. A pleasure as always. You know that.
Yes, indeed. Good talking to you.
Hi, right, buddy. Peyton Malone, WWL Louisiana forecaster. We come back. We'll talk to Louisiana. What did I say? He's from Channel 4, whatever it is. We'll talk with Henry Hartefelt when we come back, a travel industry analyst, about airlines and how they've been doing this summer. And I'd like to hear from you at 504-260-1870, the Equinor Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Let me know if you've traveled this summer by air. What has your experience been? 9:36, 24 before 10, traffic now on WWL. 9:44, 16 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I'm looking at a CNN story here, May 21st, 2025. May to June, June, July, July. Almost 3 months ago. And the headline says, Airlines Brace for the Summer of Hell. Well, that's what they said back in May. Henry Hartefelt joins us now, our friend, travel industry analyst at Atmosphere Research Group, a travel industry market research firm. How you been, Henry?
Very well, Tommy. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the time with us, as always. Let's talk about that CNN headline, Airlines Brace for the Summer of Hell. Did it turn out to be the summer of hell, or is it?
You know, it has turned out to be a little bit of heaven and a little bit of hell. Mm. Let's put it that way, Tommy. The good news is a lot of people are traveling. The TSA has so far, since June 1st, screened 3 million or more people on 5 different days this summer. They did so only once between June 1st and August 11th of 2024 last year.
Wait, say that part again?
We've got 5 days this summer from June 1st through today where the TSA has screened 3 million or more people a day on 5 days of 3 million or more travelers. Mm-hmm. But last year, between June 1st and August 11th, 2024, only one day had more than 3 million passengers being screened by TSA. So lots of people are flying. But there have been a lot of problems, Tommy. There's been a lot of bad weather that have caused diversions. We've had several tech problems that have grounded airlines anywhere from an hour or to longer. There's been problems with some of the airlines are doing better financially, United and Delta, but some other airlines are not doing well. Spirit announced that they're going to lay off 270 pilots in November and downgrade 100 captains to first officers. So not all airlines are having a great summer at all.
This CNN story said that they were expecting, and this back in May now, and I'm reviewing this, right? I'm not
sure.
Trying to make fun of them. I'm just saying that's what they predicted, that it would be
a
slow time for travel, and as a result, they were going to cut back on flights. Has that been the case or not? And how adaptive are they when it comes to cutting this flight or cutting that flight, depending on who's booked it and all of that kind of stuff?
Sure. Look, in February and March, there was March and April, there was a real slowdown in bookings because a lot of consumers were concerned or outright panicked. What would tariffs do? The economy was starting to get wobbly for some people. And so there was a market slowdown in people making reservations, in particular for the summer. That changed starting in late April, and May actually saw a lot of reservations being made as well. So CNN from the perspective CNN took, that article didn't age very well because people are traveling this summer. But people are very price sensitive, more so than they were last year. And again, that's why some airlines aren't reporting the numbers Wall Street likes to hear.
How's that real ID thing worked out?
You know, it's going well. It's funny. A friend of mine who actually works at TSA emailed me this morning to tell me that Real ID is going well. There were a few hiccups, as you would expect in the beginning. You still see it. I've noticed this, by the way, when I'm traveling, not just in and out of San Francisco, but other U.S. airports. Most people are ready for it, but there's still a number of people who don't have Real ID. But the TSA is ready. They're handling it. And one thing I will say is the TSA works with these folks to try to help them get on their planes. But, you know, when TSA is screening 2.5 to 3 million people a day, you know, they're telling me that they've got a 94% compliance rate. That's really good.
For people that don't know, if, for example, you go into to fly a plane, if you go into, hopefully if you're going to fly it, you know what you're doing. But if you go into to take a trip and you don't have a Real ID, what are your options at that point?
Okay, so Real ID applies to newer driver's licenses or state identification cards, U.S. issued passports. There's a host of other forms of identification that qualify. They are more secure. They are less tamper-proof. That's what Real ID means. Mm-hmm. If you do not have a qualifying piece of identification, the security officer may tell you that you will be subject, even if you have TSA PreCheck, by the way, to more thorough security screening. So you may have to take your electronics out of the bag. You may have to remove your toiletries from the bag. You may be subject to an additional screening like a pat down or something like that. And what they're going to try to do also is it may take you longer. They may have to do some kind of background verification that you are you. It doesn't take too much time. The TSA knows what they're doing. They're doing a good job of it. But if you don't have a qualifying Real ID, and even if you have TSA PreCheck, give yourself an extra 15 minutes or so to get through security.
Tell us about PreCheck for people that don't know what that is, and Global Entry and Clear.
Sure. Yeah. So TSA PreCheck is an optional program that the TSA offers if you're willing to share some background information about you and allow TSA to track your travel, share some biometric information like a facial scan, a picture basically that they can use for a facial scan, then you are eligible to pay a fee. It's $85 or less for a 5-year membership, and that lets you get expedited security screening. So with TSA PreCheck, you go through a traditional type of magnetometer. You don't have to, if you've got a sweater on or a blazer or a suit coat or something, you can leave that on. You leave your shoes on. Well, everybody gets to keep their shoes on now. That's good news. Leave your belt on. Your electronics stay in your bag. Your toiletries stay in your bag. And it generally takes you much less time to go through PreCheck than standard security. Global Entry is a separate program that is run by U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. Global Entry is great if you travel outside the U.S., for example, Canada or Mexico. It works if you're flying or driving. And that gives you expedited access when you're returning to the U.S. You go to a kiosk. It takes your picture, validates that you're you. You go to an officer. Boom, you're done much faster than waiting in line for customs. The bonus is if you get Global Entry, TSA PreCheck is included. So they're great time savers, and they are good to help make sure that your travels are more efficient.
I got a text that comes in asking about a Clear Me app or something like that.
Yeah, so there's something. There's a private company called Clear, and what they do is, again, that is a more expensive option. They offer expedited screening that works if you have PreCheck or not. What they do is you go to the Clear lane. They have it at New Orleans International Airport. They have a kiosk. Uses your biometric data, again, a facial scan or finger scan, thumb scan, validates your identity. Then they take you to the TSA screening line, and it helps save you a little bit of time. You know, it's expensive, and to be honest, sometimes the lines for Clear at some airports are longer than the lines for PreCheck.
Well, that doesn't help, does it?
No.
That doesn't do a lot of good. Hey, real quick, before we let you go, Henry, how responsive are airlines? What goes into canceling flights and not just, you know, for weather or something like
sure.
that, but strategically, how reactive are they? How much ahead of time do they determine this? They run numbers. Tell me about that process.
Yeah. So, excluding something like a mechanical problem or a weather problem, mm-hmm. Airlines are going to look at the flights and say, are the flights booking to the level that we expect, and are we making the amount of money that we expect? And if they're not, they're going to say, well, maybe we shouldn't run that flight. And generally what they try to do is cancel a flight 30 days or more in advance so that people can be rebooked onto other flights with as little disruption as possible. They look at factors such as connecting flights. Is this the only flight on the route of the day? Do they have a lot of cargo? Because sometimes if there's a lot of cargo, that can make more money than passengers. Mm-hmm. So they look at all of these different factors before they consider canceling a flight.
Is that a quarterly thing, or how do they do that, Henry?
No, they do it constantly, Tommy. They do it generally on a weekly basis. Some airlines may do it even more often, but they have all the booking data coming in, and their analysts are constantly looking at it. In fact, this is where you start to see AI playing a role in how airlines are managing their businesses.
59 degrees in San Francisco right now, going up to 66. Thank you, Henry. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, Tommy.
Henry Hartevelt, travel industry analyst at Atmosphere Research Group, travel industry market research firm. He got our attention because he was on the CBS Evening News with a big New Orleans poster in his office, and he's got connections to the city. Always a pleasure talking to Henry. We'll take a break, find out what Newell has planned for us when we return on WWL.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great, but it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going. Whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby, Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.